Well, nothing in our day and age seems to scare Americans like the idea of being in a long-term relationship. From a strictly observational standpoint, it almost seems like the deeper the level of commitment that a relationship requires, the more reasons we try and find to avoid it, whether that be vocationally, maritally, paternally, even spiritually. It seems that the idea of any personal obligation other people might feel toward one another, it seems to be more of a repellent toward deep and meaningful relationships than anything. I think that there are results to that. Generally speaking, I think we're becoming a culture that's less reliable and less dependable and less trustworthy. Consequently, we've become more hesitant than ever to commit ourselves to anybody else with that unbreakable and unconditional and unbending loyalty that a Christian ought to be known for. We're afraid of being hurt. We avoid relationships, the deep ones anyway, because we're afraid of being hurt. And so as a result of that, very much unlike Jesus, we safeguard ourselves from injury by keeping our personal relationships shallow. And since they're shallow, they're also disposable. Okay? When you look at the statistics of our culture, it's hard to pretend that that's not happening. 2.45 billion Facebook users, for example. And of course, I can pick on Facebook because it's worth picking on. Facebook users are investing in friendships, or I think that's what they're called. Friendships that are maintained through button pushes and clicks. Okay, that's shallow. You ever notice how at the bottom of your Facebook page there's an unfriend button? Am I right about that? There's no covenant button. I'm right about that. Did you know that in 2010, Jimmy Kimmel made November 17th National Facebook Unfriend Day? In 2010? He's a comedian. It was a joke. But it's stuck. People celebrate unfriending their friends annually. This November will be the 10th annual. We treat relationships, friendships, as disposable. In the short time that it takes for me to report this statistic, another marriage in America will give up on the covenantal relationship they had with their spouse. Because there is a divorce every 13 seconds in our country. Disposable. Since 1973, an average of 1.6 million mothers every year have given up on the relationship with their unborn baby before it even had a chance to begin. Again, disposable. Millions upon millions of relationships are being thrown away every year, and many others that are kept are superficial. The human race is becoming so afraid of relational authenticity that we keep coming up with creative ways to avoid it. And the best way we can come up with to protect ourselves from the possible hurt of an intimate relationship is to hurt or even kill other ones first. That's the remedy. But while we're growing increasingly reluctant to enter into deep relationships with other people, God's not. God's not. Never has been. God's not afraid of getting hurt. God's not afraid of deep, authentic relationships. Every member of the Trinity has demonstrated remarkable levels of bravery by involving themselves, each of them individually, in relationship with people that they know will eventually hurt them. Think of this. For the last 2,000 years since Pentecost, the Holy Spirit has been voluntarily abiding within sinful men and women whom he knows will routinely grieve him on account of their behavior, yet he indwells them anyway. That's the Holy Spirit, committed to the deepest and most abiding of relationships, even though he knows it's going to adversely affect his feelings. Think about this. Jesus Christ left the tranquility of heaven and the pleasant company of holy angels to make friends with sinners and deniers and betrayers, who in the end would mock and torture and kill him. He knew it before he came anyway. All four Gospels give crystal clear testimony of that. Jesus Christ isn't afraid at all of entering into deep commitment with people that he knows he's going to be hurt by. And then there's Jehovah God. He too has demonstrated a fearless desire for relationship that transcends any desire to protect himself from the pain inherent to those relationships. In Genesis chapter 9, God makes a promise to Noah. He pledges himself to Noah. He makes a covenant with Noah. And by verse 21 in that same chapter, Noah is blackout drunk and naked in front of his kids. In Genesis chapter 15, God makes a covenant with Abram. And seven verses later, Abram's committing what we would call adultery. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, God makes a covenant or a pledge to David. He enters into a binding relationship with this man, and only a few short chapters later, David is having a man murdered so that he can have that man's wife. Now, here's the reality of the situation is that God is omniscient, which means he knows everything, which means that he knew that each of these men would commit great moral crimes before he even covenanted himself to those men, but he covenanted himself to those men anyway. This is the God we follow. This is the God we trust. This is the God we worship, and this is perhaps why we should worship him. We're going to look a little closer at each of those three Old Testament incidences, Noah, Abram, and David. But before we do, let me say this. Because God is unafraid to become vulnerable, to make himself vulnerable and susceptible to hurt, because he's unafraid to do that and pursue deep relationships with people, and because we're made in the image of God, then that means we have the potential to bravely pursue deep and meaningful relationships ourselves, and to enjoy them to the fullest, and to experience the richness of what God promises to supply through those kinds of relationships, something that we'll never experience if our relationships are only shallow, the fullness of which we will never enjoy if our relationships are always superficial. If that kind of commitment doesn't scare God, it needn't scare us either. But it does. It does. That's the sad reality. I'm speaking statistically. We're scared to death of deep, meaningful, abiding, transparency, authenticity, all of the things that make up what God calls relationship. We're afraid of that. That's the sad reality. There's something that stops us short of giving ourselves entirely to each other. For whatever reason, we still think we have something to lose by committing ourselves to one another in a way that makes us susceptible to all the things that God gladly endures to have a relationship with us. Maybe that's the problem. We only consider the risks. We only look at what we have to lose by pursuing a relationship of that nature. So today, we're going to learn a few things that we can gain by living together in covenant. We're not going to, enough of thinking of what we might lose. We all get that relationships are scary. But what can we gain? Now, covenant is a biblical term that's used to describe the quality of relationship that God is known for. It's used 284 times in the Old Testament, another 33 times in the New Testament. So this is common language for God. The term covenant is used to describe, quote, a chosen relationship. So this is something that's decided upon. A chosen relationship in which two parties make binding promises to one another. End quote. It's also been defined as, quote, an oath-bound relationship, end quote. It's a pledge. It's a promise. It's a commitment. That's the idea behind it. One of absolute and unflinching commitment to the other party in whom you have entered covenant. So, the question today is this. What incentive do we have? And I'm not speaking in general terms like, what incentive does the church have, you know? What incentive do you have? You, by name, what incentive is there for you and I in this church to model the commitment that we have toward one another after the level of commitment that God demonstrates toward us? Are there incentives, or is it just a loss? I mean, we look at how it went for Jesus. I don't know if I want to really duplicate that. We know that the Holy Spirit's having a rough time with a few people. I'm not sure I'm interested in that. I already gave you three Old Testament examples of how it went for God. Not sure if I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, I get that. We know the risks. But we're not looking at the risks this morning. We're looking at the rewards. So turn to Genesis chapter 9, please. And we'll take a little bit of a peek into the account of Noah and God's covenant with him. We'll look particularly at verses 8 on through 17. Genesis chapter 9, verse 8, God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that's with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you. He's giving him an immediate sign, a reminder. Along with every living creature that's with you for perpetual generations, I set my rainbow in the cloud. That's the sign. It will be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I'll remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I'll look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that's on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Now, at this point in Genesis, Noah has just stepped out of the boat. Flood is over. The waters have receded enough that he won't drown himself. He's just stepped out of the boat for the first time into a decimated world that bears only perhaps a slight resemblance of the world that he left behind when he went into the boat. He's absolutely surrounded by wreck and ruin. Everywhere he looks, there's mud, dead trees, and bloated bodies. The whole world. If you just take a little bit of time to try and put yourself into those shoes, I would suggest that if ever anyone had reason for PTSD, it was him. Not to mention the fact that God has just shown what he's capable of. Imagine how afraid Noah would be to leave that boat behind. What we didn't read just a bit earlier, the very first thing God said to Noah after the flood was, "Get out of the boat now." If I'm Noah, I'm like, I kind of want to keep my boat handy in case this ever happens again. Imagine the absolute fear of obeying that simple command. Exit the ark. And go how far? You'll notice if you read chapter 8, Noah goes out and he starts sacrificing a few animals to appease this God. Like, yeah, are we good? Are we good? I'm guessing Noah's a little bit nervous. You go too far away from that ark. Good grief, if it starts raining again, I mean, the first few drops that fall, I'm in panic mode. Get the wife and kids and run right back to the boat. And God's going, no, you don't get to. It's time now to leave the ark, and you're going to spread about across the entire face of the earth. The boat part is done. And so I'm supposing that Noah was a little bit nervous. Am I fair in assuming that? Living every moment of every day, wondering if and when it could happen again. But God's making him leave. I think that God understands Noah's frame of mind at this point, and God makes a very comforting promise to him. I will never do that to you again. I will never do that again. You can trust me. It's okay to leave the boat. I won't do it again. That's the very thing that Noah needed to hear, isn't it? Now, do you know what covenant commitment does for a person? See, because we think of the risks. Entering into a committed relationship like that with others frees you from the anxiety that you feel over the turmoil of your past. It's okay. You have nothing to fear. It won't be the way it used to be ever again. To come into a relationship of that depth with someone that you know is not going to put you through what you've been through in the past is liberating. I can trust you. I can trust you. That's the first and most basic incentive that entering into a covenant pledge of loyalty and commitment to one another affords a person. Liberty. And we often avoid that because we feel safer by not getting into too deep of a relationship with people. That feels safe. You know, be standoffish and, you know, keep you at bay so that you're never too close to hurt me. And well, as safe as it may feel, being non-committal like that doesn't free you at all. And it doesn't keep you safe from feeling sorrow. In fact, it does the very opposite. Avoiding relational depth with other people locks you into a world where joy can't be experienced. Noah could have spent the rest of his life dry docked with his family in that ark for fear of what might happen if he ventured out too far, but he didn't. He didn't let fear stop him. And because he didn't, he was able to see literally a whole new world bloom and blossom before his very eyes, and the only thing that got him out of that trap was strength of a covenant relationship. The only reason he had the courage to leave that boat and the safety of his old life was knowing that somebody had his back come hell or high water. God promised, I'll never let that happen again. I'm with you. I'm with you. When God brings us into the church, he's inviting us into a community where relationships won't fall apart like they used to. Did you hear me? This is supposed to be a place where we can enter into relationship with one another in a relationship that mimics the quality of relationship that God has for people. We enter into that with one another, and it quells any fear that one may have. That the relationships may prove to be unstable, because these are the most stable relationships that are on this planet. We are a covenant people. And we're marked, or at least should be marked, by a level of commitment that can't be found in the world. Because ours is modeled after the level of commitment that we find in God. Turn to Genesis chapter 15. I won't read the entire chapter here, but you have to understand that in Genesis 15, God is covenanting himself, committing himself, pledging himself now to a man named Abram. God is making him wonderful promises and reassuring Abram that he will keep his promises and he won't let anything stop him, not natural laws of reproductive normalcy. He won't let old age interfere with the promise. He won't let enemy nations interfere with the promise. God says, I'm going to do this for you no matter what. And then in the very next chapter, Abram suffers a great moral relapse, commits a sin, and seems to have ruined the entire thing. Now, in between chapter 16 and chapter 17, many years pass, which may have left Abram wondering if his blunder had nullified the promises of God. I think that he had spent year after year after year wondering if perhaps he had made too big of a mistake this time for God to forgive, and maybe God was suddenly awakened to the quality of man that he had entered into a relationship with. In other words, Abraham blew his cover. Now God knows what kind of a guy he really is. And maybe God doesn't want to be in a relationship with a guy like that. I am supposing that Abraham had those kinds of thoughts over those following years. But in chapter 17, the very next chapter, God appears to Abram again, not to yell at him, not to disclose his being kicked out of the family. God appears to Abram again to reaffirm his covenant commitment to him. He says, no, I'm still in this. We've had a few rough years here, yeah, but I'm still in it. I'm still committed to you, committed as I've ever been. And then what's interesting in chapter 17 is that then God gives Abram a sign, and it's the sign of circumcision. He gives him a sign to remember it by. And you remember that God gave Noah his sign, the rainbow, before Noah ever got passed out drunk. Here, God waits until after Abram has committed his sin, and suddenly God comes and gives him the sign that he needs to remember how faithful God can really be. And this reveals another benefit of covenant relationships. When we allow ourselves to commit to one another in a way that says, I'll never ever give up on you, never ever. And that level of commitment is reciprocated. There is a great benefit to living a life in a community like that. living life together with other people in an unconditional environment of loyalty gives us room to spiritually blow it and still have hope of finding and fulfilling our destiny. Abraham blew it, and he still became Father Abraham, right? With many sons, many. We sing songs about him in Sunday school. We're talking about him on the other side of the planet. How many thousands of years later? He fulfilled his destiny, but he blew it. Yes, but he was in covenant. And when you're in covenant, you have great security. There is no safer place than to be in covenant with other people. Had Abram not been so fortunate as to have had the opportunity to be in covenant with someone as loyal as God, you and I would never have heard his name at all. But he was in covenant, and that saved him. That served him well. That kept him on the right track. The world won't give you that. The world won't offer you this. There's no mercy out there when you blow it. They'll just fire you. They'll divorce you. They'll kick you out. But covenant people won't, because they're covenanted to you. That's the essence of the relationship, is that when you blow it, they don't give up. And when they blow it, you don't give up. Covenant relationships remind us that our place in God's kingdom isn't won or lost by our own performance. You don't lose your spot because of your folly, nor did you ever gain that position because you were awesome. Our place isn't reserved because of your performance. Your place is kept by God's promise. Knowing that, God's people don't give up on each other just because they make a stupid move. Whew. I'm happy about that. Has your pastor ever made stupid moves? Sure has. But because I've been surrounded by loyal, God-fearing people, they didn't give up on me too quick. In fact, in spite of my stupid moves, they gave me to you as your pastor and leader. So, you know, if we go over a cliff, it's not my fault, it's theirs. We don't give up. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Now, finding this section that deals with David takes a little bit of a jump. We're going forward in the Bible quite some way. And I'm not going, again, I'm not going to read this chapter to you, but this is the chapter where God makes a promise to David. Again, he's entering into a covenant with David. He's pledging himself to David, and with it comes many wonderful promises. But the fact that we moved so far ahead in the Bible at that time means that we skipped a whole lot of material, particularly, for the sake of making my point here, we skipped all the stuff about Moses. So you've got Noah and Abram over here in the beginning chapters of Genesis, and then you've got David over here in 2 Samuel, but there's the whole part about Moses and the law that's in between. So Noah and Abram committed their sins before there was ever a clear law given to them to define really what sin was. So I don't know that drunkenness was as particularly sinful for Noah as it would be for somebody on the other side of the law where it had been made so crystal clear. Now I bring that up because David is on the other side of the law where sin has been made crystal clear. Does David know that adultery is a sin? Yes, he does. Does he know that it's a sin to hire a hitman to take out the woman who you got pregnant, her husband, so that you can keep the whole thing secret? Does David know that that's a sin? Yes, he does. And he plays cover up, and he lies to himself, and he lies before God, and he lies before his people as the king of a nation for some time. This is the same David that said, quote, I delight in the law of the Lord. This is the same David who says, I meditate on it day and night. David, of all these men, knew better. He knew better than Noah ever did. And he knew better than Abram ever did. And David did it anyway. And according to the law that he supposedly loved so much, he should have been executed. Do you know that? They should have, by law, thrown him into a pit and everybody take turns pushing boulders and throwing rocks on top of his body until he's buried and dead. Then they leave him there. But he wasn't. And that made somebody look bad. You know who? Not David. That made God look bad. You know why? Because in the Bible, Proverbs chapter 17, it says someone who acquits the guilty is an abomination. Well, who just let David off the hook? Well, who's the only other person above David? That's God. And God's just gonna carry on like nothing happened? To make matters worse, God wouldn't be able to vindicate himself and clear his reputation for another 1,000 years. So for a millennia, God looks bad. David made God look bad. But God wasn't worried about looking bad. His concern wasn't his own reputation. His concern wasn't his own feelings. His concern wasn't how he looked to anybody. God's greatest concern was David. Was just David. That's what it means to be truly committed to somebody else. It means being more concerned with their well-being than with your own good standing. That's covenant. That's called honor. And we as Christians are supposed to live with a quality of relationship with one another such that we honor each other over ourselves. God gave us that example. And wouldn't you like to be on the receiving end of that? That you have, humanly speaking, relationships with people around you who actually care about you, whose care for you rivals their care for themselves. And they will throw themselves under the bus gladly if it means helping you in some way. Wouldn't it be nice to know that you're not just being used by your friends or the people around you to make them look good? There's no better way to make yourself feel like an accessory than to avoid covenant relationships. Because if you're not in covenant with people, if they're not committed to you no matter what, you're probably nothing more to them than an adornment. They have attached themselves to you because you somehow serve their best interests. Well, listen, David wasn't serving God's best interest. At least on some level, not there. God was the one who had to come in and pick up the pieces, but he was glad to do so. Now, these are only three of the incentives of covenant relationship. I don't have time to give you all of them, but I would say that liberty, security, and honor are enough. Do you want to be in relationships with people who free you from anxiety rather than burden you with it? Do you want to be in relationships of such a quality that you feel safer than you ever have before? Do you want to covenant yourself to and have others covenant to you who are willing to honor you above even their own selves? And are you willing to do that for other people? Because these are the kinds of relationships that God has called us to in the church. Covenant relationship. Now, in light of all of that, this church, Jesus Fellowship of Believers, Duluth, a little over a year ago, made the decision to instate formal church membership here. And in doing so, we have borrowed the term covenant from Scripture as a descriptor to help people understand a little bit more of what it is to be a member of God's church, this church. Covenant membership. Not just membership. Covenant membership. It means abnormal commitment. Absolute loyalty. A level of devotion found here that is not going to be found so much in the world. It's the kind of faithfulness that honors God, because it's the quality of faithfulness that we see in Him. We began the process of covenant membership in early 2019, about a year ago, by giving consideration to those that were regulars in this fellowship who were meeting all biblical and reasonable criteria concerning church membership. The rest of last year was spent in preparation, which included formal teaching, group discussion, and individual prayer, much of it, before the application and interview process began. Okay? Nearly 1 year later, at the start of this year, 2020, we have completed the process. And with joy and a little bit of trepidation, I am going to publicly acknowledge, for the record, those who are official members of Jesus Fellowship of Believers Duluth. In no particular order, Brian Vineo, Stephanie Vineo, Adam Matthias, Annie Matthias, Seth Toline, Amber Bork, Claire Kiger, Michaela Moore, Matt Hansmeyer, Carla Johnson, Jesse Moss, Chelsea Moss, Sarah Thompson, and myself. And I'll tell you that none of these individuals are in their rookie season of Christianity, nor are they in their rookie season of being a highly involved participant in the affairs of this church. The Bible warns about accepting a novice, a new convert, somebody who's unseasoned, because it can cause problems. Now, that's speaking in particular of church leadership and the formulation of an elder board, but I also believe that that would apply to creating a membership roster. All the people in the list that I have just read have been tested. They have been watched. They have been evaluated for years. All of us, including myself. I am not without a watchful eye. I have a pastor of my own. All this to say that membership will never be easy here. It will never be fast here. Never. Okay? I've waited 18 years to become a member of the JFB church. And I had the opportunity to do so several years ago, but I waited. So I postponed membership for myself by 3 years. So I'd do it for myself. I just might do it for you also. Now, that doesn't mean that membership is impossible. It only means that this church cares a whole lot about who we're going to fill the ranks of membership with. We want the church, and I'm speaking in the greater sense, to be as strong as she possibly can, which means that our part is to make sure that this church, speaking locally, is as strong as she can possibly be. If you're not a member this morning, what can you do in the meantime? Prove yourself faithful. That's all. Prove yourself faithful. Humble. Covenanted. See, it takes time to prove the covenantal nature of the relationship a person has. We have to wait for God to test the quality of that relationship before we can guarantee what it's made of, can't we? You can't just say, and neither can I, well, I'm in covenant with you. Yeah, that's great. Thanks. We'll see. We'll see. The stakes are high for the Church of America. She's got a whole lot to lose by filling her membership roster with the weak, the carnal, the unbelieving. I think that there are plenty of churches in retrospect who would sadly agree with me, because from what they've experienced, it's become true. If a church compromises on who she lets in, the church will be compromised also in what she's able to do. And the world desperately needs the church to do everything she possibly can. And at Jesus Fellowship of Believers Duluth, we want to do everything that we possibly can. And we're doing everything we can. If you're unaware of the ins and outs of what we have going on here at this church, I'll fill you in briefly. But if you want the full context of what we're about, then you got to get involved. We have a campus ministry that really, apart from the church itself, is the backbone of this church. They meet regularly at the UWS campus in Superior. That ministry is really spearheaded by Jesse and Chelsea Moss, my assistant pastor and his wife. You guys have been down there for how many years, you guys at the helm? You've lost count. And it's easy work. So he doesn't need prayer. Everything's going just fine. It's always been a cakewalk for them. I don't think anything could be further from the truth on that. The devil, if you pay attention to just news, if you have your finger on the pulse of what's going on secular campuses, Christians are less and less welcome there. We're lucky to be on campus at all. And yet, we are right now in the process of making a move at the bigger campus up the hill, UMD. If we have our way, we will become an official student organization for the first time within weeks, hopefully. We have what we believe are all of the necessary individuals to fulfill the requests and requirements of the campus. And if we can become an organization, we will hit that campus hard. We have, as an offshoot of that ministry, a quarterly magazine that is written and published collectively by a collection of groups all across the world. Word on the Street Ministries started as a campus magazine on the UW-Stout campus in Menominee, Wisconsin, but has since branched off into several areas, including UWS branch. We take and assist in the writing of the articles and the putting together of the material, the ads. They send us the final version. We chop it up with a machete and put in our own stuff and make it applicable to our own campus. We print it, we fold it, staple it, assemble it, we distribute it, and we've been doing that. What issue is this? 43. This will be our 43rd. We, not anyone else, this church and our ministry, the 43rd issue. And we also have, for those who have moved on from street level and also really fit the criteria, are given the opportunity to participate in what we have called the community group. I don't know if we should ever come up with a different name than that. It's so generic, I don't know. And the community group is in its, it will be its third year, I think, this summer. And we are a group of, I am not going to say elderly, what are we? Postgraduate, we're not old, that's all. So, but we're no longer really appropriate for street level for various reasons. Age, one of them. Some of us, we've gotten married, we have kids. And so we're part of this community group that sole purpose is to engage the community, try and meet people, try and bless the community. We'll take on a project or two. We will do a lot of evangelizing, a lot of outreach, giveaways, and we sponsor events from time to time, even at the church. On the missions front, we have, as we speak, a team of, from this church, four individuals going to Louisiana and five individuals on the docket to the Philippines. That's nine in a church this small. We are heavily, by percentage, involved in the missions field. It's quite possible that I could be on my way to India again before too long with my wife. We are in talks with what we can do over there next, and there is no sign of us giving up on that ministry front missions endeavor anytime soon, unless, of course, their government begins to crack down so hard that it becomes virtually impossible for us to do so. Until that happens, we're going to keep pushing. There is also a blooming sort of opportunity that we have right before us in Amsterdam. Every time we go to the foreign mission field, it seems we stop in Amsterdam to reconnect with the people that we have met over the years in various ministries in the red light district of Amsterdam, one of whom has been there for many years. She's a lovely young woman named Annemieke. She ministers to the women in the red light district. She's a very interesting woman with a very interesting ministry. We have booked a flight for her to come and visit us. We've seen her many times. But now it's her turn. She's going to come to America for a week, and she will be visiting the church in Menominee, but we're going to steal her for a couple days and bring her up here. Our hope is that if we become an organization at UMD, we'd like to book a room and advertise an event where we would put her up there and say, a Christian from the red light district ministers to the women in the windows is going to come and do a talk. We'll get to spend some time with her. I think that she will be at church that Sunday. This is mid-late April. So we're looking forward to that visit, and I would encourage you to say hello when she comes. We also are involved in jail ministry on a fairly infrequent basis. About once a month, we send in 4 volunteers on Sunday after church, 2 women, 2 men, to go in and teach Bible studies to the women and the men, respectively, in the jail. So if you ever hear us talking downstairs over lunch about who's going to jail, it just means they're going to teach a Bible study. They're not staying there, okay? We have currently 5 new applicants, some pending. So our jail volunteer base is growing. It's a ministry that's very difficult, but always been sort of a traditional aspect of this church. I was the jail chaplain at the St. Louis County Jail for 7 years, and it seems that we can't peel ourselves away from jail ministry. I mean, it's about as fruitless a ministry as you'll ever have, but for some reason, God keeps us there. We've also got classes in this church, and if you're ever wondering what does it take to get involved in this church, that's where you would start, Believer's Class. It requires something extra of you, a little extra time, a little extra effort. It begins the process of testing you to see if this is what you want. It gives you the opportunity to test us to see if we're really who you want to commit to. It's mutual, okay? Beyond Believer's Class, we've also got a discipleship class that has been going for ages, where we have ongoing training, higher expectations, all kinds of curriculum and challenging things, requirements, all the rest. And beyond that, we've got a school of ministry that we run concurrently with the school of ministry that's in Menominee, Wisconsin. There is currently in this church, are you guys still students? Do I count myself? It's the program that I'm an alumni, and so is my wife for all practical purposes, and you guys are too now. But we got one current student in that class, and that's Matt Hansmeyer, and you're in your about a year and a half in, so you're halfway. It's a 3-year program. 2 weeks from now, officially, I think, we'll have another one, and she's right over there. Michaela is stepping forward, and we'll be joining the School of Ministry as well. And the stakes are higher in that environment. More is expected, more is required. But I think that, as has always been told to me, the blessings will get greater and the trials will get hotter. So pray for them. In short, our mission here at this church is the same as it's always been, and I hope will always be, and that's to disciple people. Our mission here has never been to play church. There are many other places in town that you can go to if you're looking for a church that plays the game. We're not here to play a game. We're not here to play pretend. We're here to hit the streets with our boots on and go and make a difference for the Lord. And where that starts is by being trained. Nobody gets to sign up for war and is issued their M16 and a whole strap of grenades on their very... You got boot camp first. And you can come into this church and say, well, I've been part of the church since I was a kid, you know, and I got baptized and I got confirmed and I was homeschooled and I got certificates and I got all this. Not here, you don't. Not here. And you better brace yourself, because sometimes I think people are in for a bit of a shock when they find out what it means to be a disciple according to our approach, which I believe is a biblical one. Because we don't believe in that version of discipleship where we just meet for coffee once a week and talk about our problems together. We believe in a version of discipleship that we would find in the Bible, where Jesus has high expectations, where these guys are just all but fetal position crying because that's brought them to such an end. It's what our church is here for. And so if you want to take Christianity and go as far as it will take you, then you're, I think you're in the right spot. I don't want to scare you away. You know, every college graduate started with kindergarten, so we'll give you a box of crayons and a carton of milk and a nap mat, and you can watch Sesame Street. That's where we'll start. But then there's more. And if you want more, there's more. And if you want more, there's more. God always has more. Our mission is to disciple. What's that going to require? For this church to succeed in its mission, what will it require? The answer to that, everything I've been talking about for the last 45 minutes. Covenant relationships. A never-say-die loyalty between each of us. A level of commitment that supersedes anything you'd ever find in the world. One that emulates the kind of commitment that we see from God. It will take that covenant commitment to God and to one another if we will succeed in the mission we have here to disciple Christians for greater service in the kingdom of God. A tolerance for shallow relationships is going to make our mission impossible. If we're tolerant of superficial relationships, it's not going to happen. That's why we, as a church this year, have established covenant membership. We're taking this church to the next level. Anybody who wants to come with, we're going to the next level. Father, we ask that you would give each of us in this church a special and uncharacteristically un-American passion and zeal and loyal level of commitment to the cause of Christ. And to one another, that we might accomplish what you have established us as a church to do in Duluth and beyond. Help us, Lord, to succeed in our mission. This is impossible. Unless we've got you. May our work reflect the fact that we've got you. May the fruit we produce in our lives reflect the fact that we've got you. May our relationships reflect the fact that we've got you. We just want to do this right. Help us to do this right. And we'll praise you forever.